This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wherediddtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Today has been a day of tech problems. It's been a lot of fun, and but it looks like everything should be okay now. I hope I am not jinxing myself. Today, we are going to be talking with David Matheson, and I'm just going to bring him in right now. Are you there, David?
Hi, Soraya.
And you have been very patient with these last-minute changes and possible cancellations, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking with you and Where Did the Road Go audience out there. Are we on the internet link as well, or the web link, or just over the waves?
We are just over the broadcast waves, but this will be a podcast tomorrow.
Great.
And as well, we air on a few radio stations as well. We'll be on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio Sunday and then during the week.
Or you can just, looking forward to it.
Or you can subscribe to us at wheretheroadgo.com. We're on Google Play. We're on iTunes. And we're on YouTube and Vimeo and all kinds of stuff. Stitcher. So plenty of places for people to download it for free. Now, David, how many books have you written?
I have 4 books out, Soraya. The first one that I wrote was actually more geological in nature, and then the 3 since then have been mostly talking about the stars and how they relate to myths and other things.
Right, right. And what was the geological stuff on?
Yeah, so my first book was actually called The Matheson Corollary, and actually at the time that I wrote that, I was still taking the Bible literally, but since then I've had a change in that perspective. That's obviously a pretty major change. But what I was looking at was the evidence of catastrophism on the Earth's surface, which, you know, you've been recently talking to Randall Carlson about that topic. It's an extremely important topic. It really does tie in to some of the other things that we can talk about today. But it was looking at the evidence for a global flood, mm-hmm. which obviously, the Bible talks about a global flood, as does just about every other myth system of every culture on our planet has flood myths. So there's also just a lot of geological evidence. If you look off the coasts of virtually every continent, you can see massive underwater canyons that are very hard to explain by gradualist theories. So it was looking specifically at evidence for a global flood using a catastrophist theory called the hydroplate theory, which has a lot going for it. And specifically, at first, I was trying to tie that in with certain things about the myths being related to the stars, primarily looking at things like Greek myths, because I thought, you see, there's some evidence that the Earth actually rolled. I don't really want to get too deep into the geology. Actually, I've got like 900 blog posts, and if you go back to the earlier ones, a lot of those earlier ones are you can search it.
Now, are you talking about searchable? Are you talking about like a pole shift or
not really a pole shift, but actual a roll? So that where Antarctica is today is not the latitude that Antarctica used to be, and you can find, you know, there's skeletons of like Brontosaurus or even larger than Brontosaurus type dinosaurs down in Antarctica. And, mm-hmm. and you have to say, you know, how did those gigantic lizards find enough to eat? But there's tons of palm tree fossils and things like that. So there is some evidence that the Earth actually rolled. And so what is way up in northern Canada and Greenland today might have been down in a more temperate latitude. So anyway, what I was trying to tie that in with was these myths around the world where you have the chopping down of a giant tree, like Gilgamesh in the Gilgamesh epic goes to the cedar forest. It's one of the most famous parts of the whole Gilgamesh cycle. And he has to chop down this, the tallest tree in the forest, which is guarded by this guardian that's been appointed by the solar god, actually, named Humbaba, or Huwawa is the name of the guardian. And then Gilgamesh and his companion, they're kind of this twinned pair. They chop down the tallest tree in the forest. And what I was trying to relate that to was the procession of the equinoxes, the tilt of the Earth's axis. So I'm tying together in that first book discussions of myth and geology. So just for the progression of that, at that time I was finding lots of evidence and very happy to discuss or examine the evidence that ties the different myths of the world to the constellations. But I was, perhaps obviously from based on my perspective, not applying that to the Bible. I wasn't saying, Samson is also based on the constellations, because I was taking the Bible literally.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
At what point did that change?
Well, it's kind of like the, in The Lord of the Rings, where they say that they delve too deep there in the mines of Moria. If you go deep enough down that road, you'll start to find that the entire Bible can actually be seen to be based on the stars as well. So the first book, I was using a lot of the analysis from Hamlet's Mill. It's a pretty famous mm-hmm. book. I'm not sure if you're, probably had some guests on that have maybe mentioned it, or
you
might be familiar with it. Yeah, and it's not really the most straightforward book, but there's some places in there where they will talk about biblical stories and relate those to the stars, but they won't always explain, hey, this is how the whole system works. Or actually, I don't think they ever explain, this is how the whole system works. They kind of dance around one topic and then move over to another one. But anyway, when you ask at what point did that change, somewhere after the reading of the first book, I encountered their discussion of the Samson myth. And at that time, I was involved in a Bible study about Samson, taking it literally. And I realized, that some of the things that the authors of Hamlet's Mill were talking about, specifically, he encounters this lion on the way down to meet a maiden. Then he slays the lion with his bare hands. And the Bible actually specifies that he uses his bare hands, which is similar to the Hercules or Heracles myth. He has to slay the Nemean or Nemean lion with his bare hands. But back to Samson, he's on his way to see a maiden that pleases him well, and he slays this lion. And actually, in the zodiac wheel, as the sun rises in the different constellations throughout the year, it passes through Leo before it gets to Virgo. And then later on, Samson comes back to that lion, and he finds the carcass of the lion. He turns aside, he's back in the same neighborhood where he slew the lion the last time. And then he goes and he looks, and there's a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass. And then he takes some and eats from the honey that's in the carcass. And that actually relates to another constellation, Cancer the Crab, which actually has a special cluster called the Beehive Cluster in it. And that's right. Mm. Cancer is right before Leo. So the progression is right there in the, in the scripture. It's undeniable. So that's either a coincidence or it's an indication that there's something celestial going on in that story.
Right. And so the further you trace these stories back, the more you realize the literal interpretation didn't work.
Right. Well, so you could explain that. You could say, well, there's lots. It's like any other topic that you or your guests or anybody is examining, you know, if it's a crime scene or whatever, we should look at every single possible explanation, even that kind of outside the box explanations. That's, I like to use kind of like Scooby-Doo and the gang. They show up and they kind of find the outside the box explanation that might be the actual explanation. They might notice some clues. So there's a lot of ways you could explain that. You could say, well, it just happens to be a coincidence. You know, Samson really was a literal character. Or maybe, you know, the all-powerful author of the scriptures decided to make the constellations go in that same order just to match Samson. That's a possible explanation. But what happens is, as you go through the Bible, the next one that I encountered in Hamlet's Mill was talking about the book of Revelation and some of the things that are talked about in Revelation 9, where there's these scorpion beings with stingers in their tails, and they have long hair, they have crowns. Some people have actually said, oh, this sounds like Black Hawk helicopters, maybe this is the Armageddon. But the 1969 book Hamlet's Mill said, well, look at this author back in the 1800s said that this is probably the constellation Sagittarius. And it turns out right nearby, they're talking about the smoke from the bottomless pit. This is in Revelation 9. The smoke coming up from the bottomless pit, that's the Milky Way. Right, they talk about these creatures with scorpion tails. So the brightest, thickest part of the Milky Way, it's actually rotating into view now in the night sky. Kind of in the primetime viewing hours, is right between Scorpio and Sagittarius. And there's lots of myths that use that particular widest part of the Milky Way with the Great Rift in it. There's a lot of significance to that celestial feature. But anyway, everything in that chapter of Revelation, they have crowns. There's the Southern Crown right next to Sagittarius. There's a fire coming up from the bottomless pit. There's a lot of clues, and that really that was like the second thing that I encountered after the Samson really got me started thinking about it. And the problem is, if you find too many of those, then you cannot say it's a coincidence. And actually, if you find a lot of them using the same constellations, then it's harder to say, well, maybe maybe those constellations were put there just to mirror the Samson story. Well, that's a problem if they also mirror, you know, something in a Moses story or something in a New Testament gospel story. Then the question is, well, which one of those, which one of those do you want to say literally happened if they all match the same set of stars? Yeah. And then it takes a long time, really. It's kind of like trying to learn a new language. But I started to see more and more patterns, even ones that really the authors of Hamlet's Mill or other authors that I've read don't really get into. But you can find the same system in operation in the myths of the Pacific Island cultures, like the Maui stories, or in North American myths, or in the Norse myths, or in the Greek myths, or even in some of the stories from China and ancient Japan. And Hamlet's Mill does talk about some of those. Like, they talk about some of the stories from ancient Japan. So anyway, what I started to realize is it's the same system. And Hamlet's Mill talks about, you know, it's like this ancient ruin that's worldwide in scope, and all we can really see is the outlines. And I kind of became obsessed with it and started to try and really understand the pattern. And I started to find more and more little details where I said, well, if this is correct, then I should find, you know, this over here. And if you, and when you start to find that, then you start to realize, I think, you know, this, you're starting to kind of understand the grammar of the system. I don't know if I'm kind of getting ahead of myself in trying to explain that, when it starts to have predictive power, then you can say, okay, I think, you know, actually, it's kind of like if there's this vast ruin in the jungle, you know, and different travelers have come back from the jungle and said, hey, you know, I found this ancient temple down in you know, Central America. It's really interesting. It looks like it might connect up with some other things. And you kind of start putting maps all over your walls and putting string between this piece and that piece and puzzling over it and scratching your head and going and looking at it day and night. And then one day you say, wait, I think I see the outline. If this is correct, then I should be able to run off to this point in the jungle that no one's ever found anything. And if I'm right, there should be kind of the back door to the temple should be right there. And you go tromping through the jungle, and if you start clearing away the vines and you find a stone doorway, then you're probably on the right track.
Right, right. So I know with Hamlet's Mill, they talked about this being a way of keeping the information about the precession of the equinoxes, which is not something that ancient people would need on a day-to-day life. I mean, obviously the stars would be important for navigation and such. Why was the precession important?
Oh, that's a great question, Soraya. So the precession, first of all, is a very subtle phenomenon. It takes, you know, 72 years to even notice movement of 1 degree. It's not even something that's extremely easy to explain. I have a video on my website where I use kind of a metaphor of a dining room table. And if we want to get into it, I could explain kind of what causes it or what one theory of what could cause it is. But to get to your question of why, okay, let's just grant for the sake of argument that perhaps the Bible uses celestial metaphor, that perhaps the Greek myths use celestial metaphor, that perhaps even all the myths of the world, which if you start making that claim, there's all kinds of ramifications for kind of ancient history as to, Well, how did these cultures separated even by not just by great distances, but by great vast gulfs of time end up with the same system. But let's just grant for the sake of argument, why would anyone do that? Just to encode the precession of the equinoxes? What? So nobody forgets that kind of, graduate level astronomical information?
Yeah.
I don't think so. What I actually, you know, I was taking the Bible literally. So when I started to encounter those kinds of things, then I had to ask myself that question as well. Is okay, does this mean that I actually think that people are attracted to ancient scriptures, whether it's the Bible or any of the other ones, because they're full of actual truth that and beauty that we need for our lives. They're actually given for our benefit. But I think unless we understand that they're talking in a celestial language, we might miss that message. And I believe that they're actually using these celestial motions as a kind of esoteric way of conveying the information. Just like when Mr. Miyagi was trying to teach Daniel-san in the first Karate Kid movie, he didn't say, okay, Daniel-san, now I know you're having this trouble with this bully at school named Johnny, and he's got a wicked roundhouse kick, and he puts his shin right through your head, you know, and it's coming really fast. So next time it's coming, I want you to put your hand just like this, at this angle. He doesn't say that. He starts giving him jobs like wax the car and
right.
Paint the fence and sand the and paint the house. And finally, Daniel-san says, what am I doing this for? Why? How come I'm just waxing all your cars, Mr. Miyagi? He gets really angry. Mr. Miyagi is explaining something that Daniel couldn't grasp at first, and he did it in an esoteric way. He taught him something that had hidden meaning, and he didn't teach him to wax the car in order to hide the knowledge. He knew that Daniel couldn't get the knowledge unless he did it in a certain way, because there's certain things that our mind learns better that way. In fact, that we can't even grasp things that are maybe like really mind-bending, that are kind of normal logic, which is great for a lot of things, might get in the way for certain types of other things. Like Daniel-san might, if Mr. Miyagi just launched in with a bunch of physics of how to stop this kick, Daniel's logical mind, which is very good at getting him through the 11th grade math or whatever, might say, but wait a minute, what if his kick is like this? Or will that really work? I've got my doubts. And all these questions, all these doubting parts of his brain, which are very necessary for our survival, but are not necessarily great if we're trying to maybe make a three-pointer from the top of the arc under pressure with 2 seconds to go. You don't want to be sitting there thinking about, okay, now, can I really make this shot? You have to get into a certain different kind of mind.
Right.
And so there's reasons for using the esoteric, and that's what I believe these ancient myths are doing. They're telling us something about our human nature, actually about the nature of the world, where if I were to just blurt it out, you would go, ah, that sounds ridiculous, or my logical mind doesn't really like that, or hold on, you know, my logic is choking on that. Our, like Daniel Sam would choke on the information, our doubting part of our mind would choke on the information. So they encoded in this esoteric way, and procession was used as one symbol in that, a very powerful symbol. It's used in some of the most important myths of the world, the Osiris and Isis myth, and in the Odyssey. It can be clearly seen to be in the Odyssey. We can talk about that. And it has to do with dislocation. The procession is a dislocation of the way things should be. And it has to do with the fact that when we're here on this earth, we're actually not just a, I'll tell you what I think procession is about. We're here, we're not just a physical being as much as, you know, certain college classes will want to tell you, actually, all your thoughts can be boiled down to a physical thing. Your brain, you know, creates your reality. So therefore, your mind is actually created by a physical function in your brain. I think the ancient myths are telling us not only that's not true, we actually have a spiritual aspect. Not only that, we're actually living in a universe that is simultaneously spiritual and physical at the same time, right down to every single atom, you know, in the universe. Every rock and tree has actually got a spiritual component to it. Every stream has a spiritual component to it. And so the processional theme has to do with the dislocation of a spiritual being stuffed into a physical body. And on our first birth, you know, we get a coat of skin, so to speak. We get stuffed into a human body, but we're actually supposed to start to realize that that's not all that we are. We're supposed to remember where we came from. And so putting that dislocation, repairing that dislocation in our own experience is actually part of what I think these myths are trying to explain to us how to do.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, procession is one of those things that science has a very hard time explaining. I always liked Walter Cruttenton's work on a binary star system, how we may actually have a binary partner that causes procession.
I'm glad you mentioned that. So actually, I did want to mention, a great segue, thank you, Soraya, that Walter runs the conference on procession mm-hmm. and ancient knowledge each year. So I'll be speaking at that this year.
Oh, awesome.
And Robert Schock will be there, and Walter, of course, will be there. And
when is that this year? Is it still in September?
It's the last day of September and the first 2 days of October, which happens to also coincide with a new moon. So now we're fixing to have a full moon, right? So you can't really see the constellations that I'm talking about. Like if your listeners go outside right now, you know, the sun's still, you can't see any stars here where I am in California, but there you can see Scorpio and you can see Ophiuchus and Sagittarius over there in New York right now. But the problem is the moon is almost full. At this conference on procession and ancient knowledge this year, I'll be leading a stargazing on the first night, and it's a new moon night, so we should have really good views of the stars there in the desert down in Rancho Mirage. So I'll point out, intend to kind of, point out a few constellations that maybe people have never been able to spot themselves and then say, you know, hey, we'll be talking about these and some of the discussions during the conference, but this is, you know, this constellation relates to so much in the Greek myths or in the Bible or in the, you know, the Maui story or even in Australia, Africa. This same system seems to be worldwide. But anyway, back to your point about precession, Walter, you know, I've talked to Walter in person several times. I really like talking with Walter. He's I really like the way he talks about kind of the ages, the cycles.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of the theme of the conference each year. I think this is the 10th annual conference. But he does have this theory that precession could be caused by something other than the conventional explanation is that it has to do with the conservation of angular momentum. You know, I was just listening to your interview over the last couple of days of Randall Carlson. Great interview, by the way. One of my favorite interviews of Randall, I think, that I've heard
was the one you did.
Yeah, it was great. And he talked about some, he kind of put it all together in some great ways that I thought was fantastic the way you two interacted. But he kept talking about, you know, the Earth's an oblate spheroid because it's wider at the equator than it is. You know, if the distance between the two poles is different than the distance across the center of the Earth from one side of the equator to the other. But because we're tilted, you see, this is where the precession comes in. If the Earth has got an obliquity of the eclipse, that's the conventional explanation for the seasons. If the Earth is a sphere, you know, I'm not in the flat Earth camp. We can talk about that. But anyway, if the Earth is a sphere and it's tilted on its ecliptic and it's wider at the equator, because it would be, if it's spinning, centrifugal force is going to make it fatter along its belt line, right? Because
It's
spinning like a donut. It's getting flattened by its spin. But if you tilt that spin, then you're going to create a physics, the law of conservation of angular momentum is going to cause it to actually start to wobble like a gyroscope. You can see online physics teachers in high school doing this kind of with a spinning bicycle wheel on a string. But it'll start to turn like a gyroscope, and that is one explanation for the precession of the equinoxes. And then Walter has a different approach and says it's possible that that explanation does not explain all the evidence that we find. So that's actually ties back. You know, I sometimes tend to make big looping going off in a direction and try and hopefully tie back. But it ties back to what I was trying to say at the very beginning. I think you have to look at all the possible explanations and say, well, what fits the evidence the best? And, you know, I'm not dogmatic at all about what causes the precession of the equinoxes, but I will say that there is abundant evidence that the precession is encoded into various myths. And I'm not, obviously not the first person who said that. Hamlet's Mill talks about that. Jane Sellers talks about that in Death of Gods in Ancient Egypt. But the conventional storyline will still tell you that, oh no, precession wasn't even understood until Hipparchus. You know, there's no way. And so that causes problems because it's actually a very sophisticated, you have to be able to make very precise notation about where a star is on a specific day of the year, and you have to observe it from the exact same point on the Earth over and over. And even if you do that for 72 years straight, you'll only be able to notice 1 degree of motion, and that 1 degree is only, it has to be like from July 31st to where you see it the next July 31st. And you have to do that for 72 years before you even notice 1 degree. And if you think about a human lifespan, you know, there's not too many people who are going to be able to do that in their own lifetime unless they start when they're 5, you know, and keep doing it for 72 years.
Yeah.
So they've got to have good records, be able to pass it on to the next person who's going to look at it and the next person. And then they have to start to say, wait a minute, I think we're detecting some motion here. And then there's actually evidence that they had determined the rate of the processional slippage
yeah.
to a pretty fine degree, and then encoded that into ancient myths like the Osiris story, which are found in some of the very earliest texts that we have, like the pyramid texts. So anyway, they actually had a higher degree of accuracy on the processional constant in or evidence of it in some of these myths than Hipparchus or even Ptolemy. Ptolemy said, well, I think we've narrowed it down to it cannot be 1 degree. It has to be 100 years or less to do 1 degree. He didn't know exactly what the number was. The actual number, you know, according to what we think it is today, is 1 degree every 71.6 years. And this is getting, now we're getting into kind of pretty technical stuff, but 1 degree every 71.6 years, it's hard to kind of incorporate that into myth. So it's usually rounded to 72, but we see 72 in a lot of myths. And in fact, Osiris is, Plutarch tells us, and he's kind of a late source, but still he's before Ptolemy. He tells us that Osiris was killed by his brother Set, or Seth, Set and 72 henchmen. And actually, Osiris is associated with the constellation Orion. And then Set put Osiris's body into a sarcophagus and floated it down the Nile River out to the sea. So what precession does is it delays the constellation so that after thousands of years, Orion would not be as far up above the horizon on a certain day as you might be expect, as he would be expected to be. If you've been keeping records, you say, wait, he seems to be delayed. And eventually it's like he's not making it above the horizon. Now he's barely making it. And that can be encoded in myth as he's drowning, or he's being drowned, or he's being held down below the surface.
Right.
And so that shows up in all these different myths that way. And when you start to see those sorts of things, you can say, oh, looks like this is a processional, you know, there's some procession involved in this myth.
And you mentioned the flat Earth thing for a moment, which I don't think we've ever actually discussed it on this show. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, so it's not my intention to discuss it on the show if you never have, and I'm not trying to get us into one of those because it's a contentious issue.
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting issue in a symbolic sense. In that you could say, well, the only thing we really know is what we're told. I mean, we can't individually go up and fly around the Earth and know that, you know, what we're being told is true. I mean, you could hypothetically hide any number of things from the general public, and they wouldn't know.
Yeah, so, and that's what gives the theory its strength, because I think they are hiding some things from the general public.
Oh, I'm sure they are.
It doesn't necessarily mean that the Earth is flat. But so that's a great, it actually ties back. But you know what? It ties back to what we were saying about, well, we have to look at all the evidence, and we should, I think, entertain all the possible explanations for the evidence. So I don't have any problem with someone saying, hey, couldn't we explain all the evidence that you just described for a round Earth with a flat Earth? Why can't we? And unless you can find some evidence that doesn't fit the flat Earth theory, we should at least entertain it, right? And we could say, look, unless you have a rocket, unless you've been to 30 miles above the Earth or 15 miles above the Earth, how do you really know? I actually have a blog post where I try to provide 12 reasons why you actually can know even without going up into a rocket. For instance, I have been to New Zealand and Australia, and the constellations that I saw myself are upside down to my way of looking at it down there.
Right.
So Orion, the way I see Orion when I'm standing in the northern hemisphere, when I got down to the southern hemisphere, first of all, I got to see the Southern Cross for the first time. Okay, that was cool. Why can't you see it in the northern hemisphere if the Earth is flat?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Maybe there's an explanation for that. But then Orion is also down there upside down, which is what you would expect if the Earth is a ball and we're both looking at a poster on the wall, right? And the poster looks right side up from the northern hemisphere, and then you go down to the bottom of the ball and stand on the South Pole, you know, you don't feel upside down, but on the ball you are upside down, and you're looking at the same wall, you're going to see that constellation upside down to mm-hmm. the way as if you were standing on the North Pole. So not everyone I know can just hop in a plane and go to New Zealand right now, but if you want to, you don't have to be an astronaut. You can fly to Australia and see all the constellations upside down, which is difficult to explain, I think, flat Earth. I really don't think, frankly, I'm not sure anyone truly believes the flat Earth. I have a suspicion that maybe it's just thrown out there kind of like a sophistry, like, hey, can you argue against this? I do have some friends who claim to really believe it, and maybe they do. That's great. Everyone's got to kind of, you know, everyone I think should be sovereign over their own mind, and we should let them figure out their opinions and wrestle with it, not try and, you know, I mean, but there's some people who say, oh no, you can't think that. No, you shouldn't even ask it. If you ask that question about 9/11, you're not patriotic.
Well, right, right.
That's not a rational way of looking at things. So I think people should go ahead and ask the question about the flat Earth. But sometimes people will say, well, look, you think that the ancients are so sophisticated. You're talking all about these myths, Dave. And you claim to think that they're beautiful and have a lot of truth in them. So why don't you just accept what they say about the Earth being flat too? Well, they don't actually say the Earth is flat. And the bulk of what we should really be talking about is, my argument is that the myths and the scriptures and the sacred stories of the world are all, they're talking about the stars. They're not talking about the terrestrial Earth. Mm-hmm. The things that they're talking about happening actually don't work on the terrestrial Earth. We can talk about an example of that, like the visit of the Magi does not work for terrestrial Earth, but it works just fine for the celestial stars. So when somebody uses the scriptures of the world as a support for the flat Earth, I would say, actually, I never said you had to take the scriptures literally in order to respect what they say. In fact, I think when you take them literally, you end up with the wrong message. But they're actually metaphorical, and they're talking about the stars, but they're not just talking about the stars in order to pass on a bunch of astronomical knowledge or even astrological knowledge. They're actually talking about your spiritual journey, your consciousness journey. They're talking to you, and all those things that happen to Achilles or to Odysseus or to Isis they're supposed to be telling us, they're actually about you. They're not really about Achilles at all, because he's a constellation. He's a metaphor for something that has to do with your life, that can actually help you, you know, that's part of your journey. Anyway.
Can you explain that to people a little better? Like, give them an example?
Yeah, sure. So, so for instance, you asked about my four books. The first one, we talked a little bit about that. Then I wrote The Undying Stars, which is after I started to realize that all the myths and scriptures of the world are based on the stars. And then I started a series called Star Myths of the World and How to Interpret Them. And the first volume, and the purpose of that is to show that actually all the myths all the way around the world, from North America to Australia to Europe, are based on the stars. And then kind of explain what they might be trying to tell us. So for instance, in a lot of myths, we have a giant war, like the Trojan War, or in the ancient India, the Mahabharata. It's spelled Mahabharata. I think they pronounce it Mahabharata, but it's a gigantic battle, the Battle of Kurukshetra, between the Pandus on one side and the Kurus on another side. It's just like the Achaeans or the Greeks against the Trojans in the Trojan War. Well, that is not really about an ancient war. It encodes a lot of symbolism that has to do with the seasons of the year, like the upper half of the year, the summer months when the daylight is longer than the night time each day. That's kind of the upper half of the year, the summer months, where if, you know, the sun isn't going down till 9 p.m. Whereas in the pit of the year, the very bottom of the year at winter solstice, it might be pitch black at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So that endless struggle between hours of daylight and hours of night has to do with, it's in a lot of different myths. It's in the Tao Te Ching. It's in the Tao. It talks about this endless interplay of things. You see it in the yin yang symbol. And it's talking, I believe, using one half of the year as talking about the spiritual side and one half of the year talking about the material side. Like the stars themselves, if you go outside and look up into the night sky, you're actually staring off into infinity. You're looking at the infinite realm. You're looking at stars that are not impeded by the earth. They're not running into any, you know, physical things as they arc across the sky, or the sun. But at the end of the day, we see the sun sink down and hit the horizon and disappear into the earth. Or if we're looking out across the ocean, we'll see it sink down into the water. It's like it's going down into the lower realms, right? When it's up there in the crystal blue sky, it's in the heavenly realms. So the myths around the world, I believe, are using the upper journey as the realm of, that's the realm of spirit, that's the realm of the higher elements of air and fire, and then they all plunge down into the lower elements of earth and water. And we're made out of earth and water, right? In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, you know, Adam's given a body that's made out of the lower elements. He's made out of clay, which is earth and water. But so I don't believe that Adam is a literal person. It's right. Talking about you and me. Adam and Eve are actually, they're telling us something about, hey, you have, you're in the lower, we're in the lower passage right now. We're like the sun after it sets. We're figuratively speaking, we're plowing through kind of the harder part of the journey, the underworld journey. And Osiris was like a god of the underworld. He was the sun after it sets in the west and has to plow its way back underground. I don't think that the Egyptians actually thought the world was flat. I think they knew it was round. But metaphorically speaking, Osiris is the sun as it's plowing from the west back to the east in the underworld. And then, boom, it pops up on the horizon, on the eastern horizon, and soars up into the air. That's Horus. That's the sun in the upper realms. That's the celestial realm. So in the myth of like the Trojan War, it's talking about the interplay of matter and spirit. And we're all wrestling with that right now. That's why we're in the Trojan War, so to speak. We're wrestling with the interplay of spirit and matter. So I just said a lot there. We can tie it right into it. You know, if you want to zero in on one particular myth, that's fine. We can do that. And I can... But what I'm saying is they do use a celestial language. Mm-hmm. And I believe that I argue that they use a celestial language. And my two most recent books are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of showing the celestial language. We could talk about in more detail a little bit kind of how I do that. But I believe there's so much evidence that they're using a celestial language. It's very hard to deny that they're using a celestial language. And then I believe that if you can understand that language, then it opens up all kinds of new insights and perspectives because a myth might reference a certain part of the zodiac circle, like Virgo, like we mentioned in the Samson myth. Virgo is at a certain place on the zodiac. She's at the fall equinox or the autumnal equinox. So that has that there's a whole language of symbol that has to do with, okay, well, what's the fall equinox all about? Well, that's where the hours of darkness start to take over. We used to have longer days than nights, but once we cross that point of fall equinox, we're moving down into the lower part of the year. Now night is starting to prevail. So whenever Virgo shows up in a story, it might be referencing that fall equinox. So there's a whole host of kind of codes that go along with, well, what does the fall equinox mean? And it's part has to do with that's our birth. That's our first birth. That's when we plunge down into a human body. And maybe we do it several times, you know, in a kind of a reincarnation way. But if Virgo is being referenced, and if you understand the language, then you can say, oh, okay. So this myth has to do with kind of that the first birth. But in a lot of these stories, actually, there's two mothers, or there's two births, or there's a set of twins, because you're supposed to have a second, you're supposed to have a spiritual kind of awakening where it's you start to come to your senses and say, wait a minute, I've been thinking that, you know, the physical is all that there is, but actually I'm starting to realize that's not all that there is. So there's different parts on the zodiac wheel that will reference that.
So do you think this is part of the reason this knowledge was retained, not just for the precession of the equinox data, but because these myths hint at so much more?
Absolutely. That's what I think they were intended to teach. And in fact, that's what I think that most of the world, actually, I think you find a lot of similarities between some of the things that are taught, say, in some of the yogic texts, or, you know, in Hinduism or Buddhism or Taoism. You'll find some similarities to some of the things that are talked about in North American belief systems, that the whole universe, we're not separated from the universe. We're supposed to realize that, all creatures have value. And so I think some of the dislocations and terrible kind of, horrendous things that we do to animals, if you drive past, a chicken farm or something,
yeah,
you say, oh my goodness, I had no idea that was actually, how could we be so inhumane? How did we get off on this wrong turn? Or now we're doing genetic modification of this, 90% of the corn in the United States is genetically modified. And now we've got people saying, I think we should release a bunch of genetically modified mosquitoes into the atmosphere. It's like, well, I don't think that's a good idea at all. I think we've gone off on a horrible wrong turn. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we've been cut off kind of from the teachings that were given to humanity that you find all around the world. If you take the myths literally, what happens is you invert their meaning. You can actually turn their meaning on its head, because if it's actually got a spiritual meaning, but you try and force it into a physical meaning, like, oh, well, this child of Noah was bad. So all his descendants, it's okay if you enslave them or oppress them or whatever. It's, that's part of the, no, that story is not about that at all. But actually it has been taken that way. When you force it into a literal meaning, you can come up with some very wrong, I believe, wrong or damaging conclusions. And anyway,
what?
So yes, the answer to your question is yes. I think these stories are trying to convey some actually very beneficial truths that are a blessing to people. And all the scriptures, you can see it in the Bible, but it's actually worldwide, talk about blessing versus cursing. And I think they're given to us as a positive thing, but I think they can be twisted into the opposite.
So before we run out of time, let's get to where do you think these stories originated?
Right, so that's a great question, Soraya.
Maybe an unanswerable question at the moment, but
we'll wrap that up in 6 minutes, and everyone will know. I don't know. The answer is these are worldwide. And of course, you know, we've talked about, well, you should look at every possibility, and one possibility. A lot of people would say, oh, well, if you see it popping up in Australia and you see it popping up in modern day Norway, in, you know, the Norse myths, you know, what is today Norway, that doesn't mean that they're connected. They could have both come up with the same thing independently. That's a counter argument.
Right.
But actually, some of these examples we could get, we don't really have time to get into them, but I do in the books and actually in some of my blog posts. Some of the parallels are just striking in their detail to where it'd be very hard to argue this just popped up independently. For instance, there's a certain story of the failed baptism. Like, you know, Achilles was supposed to become invulnerable. His mother put him into the river Styx, or in some versions into a fire to make him invulnerable, but she didn't get the part that his heel, you know, his Achilles heel was vulnerable.
Right.
You find that same failed baptism story in the Maui myth. And it actually relates to a specific constellation that if I were to point it out to you in the sky, you would say, wait a minute, that doesn't look like a baby. And yet it is used as a baby all around the world in all these different myths, even in the story of Solomon and the judgment of Solomon, where they bring the two women bring the two mm-hmm. babies to Solomon. The same constellations are at play. And you say, wait a minute, how could they possibly all be using this very specific and kind of weird way of interpreting the constellation, and yet they all can be shown to be doing that, I believe. So how did that happen? And my response is I have no idea, but it could happen in a lot of different ways. It could be contact, but the problem with the, you know, it's hard to say, well, maybe the Egyptians sailed around and told everybody, or maybe, because some of these stories, you know, the Egyptians might not have, the Polynesian people might not have been in the Pacific Islands where they, you know, as 4,000 or 5,000 years ago when the Egyptians were writing about it,
right.
it crosses massive gulfs of time. So what I think probably the most likely explanation is there's some lost civilization, some ancient, now forgotten civilization that all of these are probably descended from in their different parts of the world, and they've taken on different costumes or different kind of external details, and they may have diverged in different ways because different people, different cultures, different environments, different climates or whatever, but they still retain some characteristics from some ancient, you know, it could have been an ancient human civilization, could be, you know, I'm not an ancient alien proponent, but you know, it could be from the gods brought the same stories to everybody. I don't know, but the fact is it's found worldwide, or I find evidence to argue that it's found worldwide.
Yeah, and that goes back even beyond the legends of like the civilizers that came to these different cultures, doesn't it?
Well, I think these civilizers are actually metaphorical too, because the civilizers are usually these gods, you know, and we could say, well, this one lines up with the planet Jupiter, or this one lines up with the planet Saturn. But that's why... See, what Randall was talking about is so interesting, because he was talking about, well, you know, the Earth has probably experienced some catastrophes that are so massive that they may have just wiped out civilizations.
Oh, sure.
You know, without a trace, and maybe that's where these things came from. That's why it kind of ties together, like we said at the very beginning, my first book was about catastrophes. I think there's overwhelming evidence that most of what we find on Earth was shaped by catastrophes, the Grand Canyon and the you know, undersea canyons and things like that.
Well, you know,
we could talk about the different mechanisms, but I think that is a huge part of the puzzle.
And when you think about this, you look at the Antikythera device, and we were just talking recently about how they were able to finally read the inscriptions on it, which are tiny. And it says where it was built and when it was built and stuff like that. And it came from the Greek culture. So this very advanced device, the Greeks were using. We had no idea they had it. Even when we found it, we couldn't figure out what it was. What I mean, if we're missing something that major in our known cultures, what, you know, how massive of things could have been 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, before the sea level rise, before the end of the ice age. You know, we have Göbekli Tepe and we got Gudang Padang.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be about it.
Well, and I believe the someone who's an expert on it can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it encodes precession, or it has a mechanism in there that somehow incorporates precession into
it,
which is astonishing. First of all, you have to understand precession. Then you have to say, well, how could we incorporate that into a mechanism? But yeah, it's very advanced. And actually the spiritual knowledge that I believe is encoded in all of these myths. I believe these myths around the world, whether they're in Australia or Africa, and Australia is a very ancient, the conventional understanding is that Australia was isolated without a whole lot of contact for tens of thousands of years. And yet the same system, I believe, can be, and I talk about that in one of my Star Myths books, is found in some of the Australian myths. So this this system is I believe it's got to be very ancient, but it's also extremely spiritually sophisticated. And I think it also has to do with being able to go over to the spirit realm, or what, you know, what we can say for shorthand is kind of a shamanic worldview. I know that word gets abused and some people don't like, you know, applying it broadly, but what I mean by that is the view that there's a spirit world and you can go there. There's some information that you can only get by going there. There's some things you can fix, like, you know, certain diseases can only be healed by a shaman or other person who's able to go there and come back. I believe that the use of the stars is talking about the invisible realm. They use that as a way of picturing the invisible realm to say, look, there's an invisible realm and you need to get in touch with it in certain ways. And you can get in touch with that in all kinds of different ways. You can get in touch with that through doing yoga or Tai Chi. But I believe that, you know, that's a component that is a beneficial component that was given for our benefit. It can also be used in negative ways too, of course. But that I believe that that could also be a source, like, where did all this come from? Maybe individuals who are exceptionally able to go into the invisible realm brought it back in their various cultures from there.
Yeah. I mean, that to our worldview is impossible, because we don't think of those things as being real. We think of altered states as not being a real place. So how could actual information be encoded in it?
But oddly enough, if quantum physics is not a gigantic hoax, right? You know, we could talk about the flat Earth theory. We could start another theory that's the anti-quantum physics theory. But I think quantum physics has been pretty well, Albert Einstein didn't want to accept it.
Yeah.
But actually, it talks about kind of a realm of pure potentiality. Like this subatomic particle happens to be existing in a state of pure potential right now. And then when you open the box or the double slit, then all of a sudden it manifests itself into one or the other or whatever. So quantum physics actually kind of almost against sciences. They didn't really want to. When they first started seeing these experimental results, they didn't want to say, wait a minute, that can't be. They didn't want to accept what they were seeing, but they pretty much had to come up with a whole concept of, there seems to be this implicate realm that still hasn't unfolded yet. It's the realm of potentiality. It's the realm of pure potential where things haven't manifested, like the seed realm. I mean, there's different metaphors that are the realm of the gods. The gods are in a realm of pure potentiality. It's like, where is that redwood tree or that oak tree when it's just in its acorn? It pops into a tree eventually, but where was it before? Well, it was kind of in the potential world. How many branches did it have when it was there? Well, It could turn into an oak with 40 branches or 42 branches. Right now, it's still just potential. So there is actually science. Certainly, the way we've been kind of taught to think is to say, oh, no, there can't be a shamanic type realm or an invisible realm where there could be information. But actually, all the myths of the world, including the Bible, talk about, oh, I was in the spirit for 3 days. Or Daniel, in the book of Daniel, says, I was dreaming with my face to the ground. That's a very strange posture. That's actually a posture that you find in shamanic cultures, like in, you know, far northern Europe, the Lap or the Sami people, when they're going into a trance state. They're lying flat on the ground with their face down. If you look in the book of Daniel, you'll see he talks about, well, I had this vision while I was lying flat out on the ground with my face to the ground. He was going into that same realm, potentially, or the scriptures telling you about the same sort of thing. But to tie it back to science, I think the quantum physics is trying to tell us we've had to admit the possibility of a realm something like what the scriptures are talking about, the ancient scriptures of the world. I'm not talking about just the Bible. I'm talking about the sacred stories of Australia, where they talk about going into the dream time. It's another realm.
All right. So where can people find your work online?
Sure. My website is called starmythworld.com. You can actually just do a search for my last name and the word stars, and you'll come across. I've got a blog that's kind of been going for several years now, so it comes up pretty quickly. If you type in Matheson, which is Matheson, and the word stars, you'll probably land on my blog. Is called the Matheson Corollary. The first one, that was the name of my first book, so that's when I started that blog. And then later I started a website called starmythworld.com, which has a little bit more information, but it also contains the entire blog. So if you just do a search for Matheson and stars, you should get to something that can take you to starmythworld.com.
Okay, and the books?
Yeah, so there's actually a section under starmythworld.com that's called books, and then it's got the covers of all four books that you can click on and see some sample content there. They're all available on Amazon, but also with your local bookstore. If you don't want to be, you can support your local bookstore. You can go to your local college library and say, hey, can you please stock this book? I'd like to read it, but I'd rather you buy it. You can do that. Your local bookstore should be able to get it for you. You know, how fast they can get it, I don't know, but it's on Barnes and Noble. All my books are on Barnes and Noble. The most recent ones are called Star Myths of the World. I've got Volume 1 and Volume 2. Volume 2 is all about the Greek myths. Volume 1 touches on, so they're almost like a textbook. Volume 1 kind of starts, it's like you're building a vocabulary, so it's kind of, I'm trying to just drop in a few constellations, kind of educate the reader in a like progressive manner. So by the time you get to Volume 2, there's more advanced, but that's all the Greek myths, which is actually, I think it's a better way to dive right into just one myth group and spend a whole book on that. The first one, I, for a variety of reasons, I moved from one culture to another, just trying to really show that this is worldwide. This is, this actually, I think, unites all people. This, you know, we, so too often we're divided by, they believe a pagan thing, and so they're wrong.
Right.
This actually shows that the Bible is close cousins to the Greek myths, is close cousins to, they've been interpreted differently, but if you read them celestially, you'll see they're actually using very similar patterns as the Greek myths.
Hmm. And you have a third one coming out?
I'm working on stuff all the time. I'll let you know when it's ready. But yes, I envision that Star Myths of the World series. You know, there's so much. I'm forced to constantly say, hey, I could write a whole book. I have to apologize because could write a whole book on just Moses, but we can only look at a few of Moses's things. So I really envision going into the Norse myths and, you know, some of the other myth systems of the world. So yes, volume one and volume two are out now, and we'll see if we can get some more out there for people.
Okay, so you don't have like a release date for volume three or anything like that?
No, I don't. But, you know, volume two is over 700 pages. I think volume one is 600 pages. So if you start in on, you could start right in on volume two if you're really into the Greek myths, but it's kind of jumping into the deep end a little bit. If you want to kind of build up to it, by the time you finish those, there may be a volume three. We'll see.
All right. And meanwhile, you keep the blog pretty regularly updated?
Yes, I try and do that. So I kind of learn by writing. So the blog is kind of my workout. It's like the boxing gym where I kind of work out some of the topics that will find their way into the book. So the blog, you know, usually once a week or sometimes more frequently, you can find that on the website Star Myth World, or just by looking for Matheson Stars or Matheson Corollary.
Okay. Well, we're definitely going to have you back because I feel like we barely scratched the surface here.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I went off on some big long tangents, but I really enjoyed talking with you.
Yes, I enjoyed talking with you too. I mean, this stuff is very interesting and I think important. I don't think people realize the importance on numerous levels of this information. You know, it's not just, oh, this is interesting, but it. Where did it come from? What does it mean that all this stuff is united? I mean, these are big questions for who we are and how we get such detailed information.
Yeah, no, we didn't even really get into the practical aspects of it, but it's really about kind of connecting with, you know, the things that you learn in yoga or in kung fu. I mean, if you just kind of think of pop culture like The Matrix or maybe kung fu movies that you saw from the 70s, you know, there's usually characters in there where you're like, or Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? He's this Jedi. You don't see Obi-Wan Kenobi like throwing a vase against the wall in a temper tantrum going, he's reached some kind of state. That's, he's connected. He's an integrated individual.
Right.
It's not just male characters. That's just who I'm pulling off the top of my head. But it's kind of like, The Matrix. If we were to watch The Matrix, it's a wonderful story. It's fun to get lost in it. But it's really about, hey, you're actually supposed to be like Neo. You're actually supposed to wake up.
Yeah.
You're actually supposed to realize, hey, you've kind of been living in a lot of illusions. Wake up. There's more to this environment, this program that you're in, then meets the eye. That's actually what I believe. You can just read the Odyssey as your Bible, and it has everything in it that you need for life. It's like it's telling you how to become like the Obi-Wan Kenobi or the goddess. I mean, it's telling you how to integrate with your best self. I know that sounds a little new agey, but it's actually, so you know it when you see a character in a movie where you're like, ooh, that person, I wish I was like that.
Right.
Unfortunately, I'm not like that all the time. You know, I lose it. I feel, I blow it. Oh, I wish I said that. Well, it's like in the Odyssey, he loses it a few times, but it's like he knows what to do in every situation. And he's the one, in the Odyssey, Odysseus, he's the one who listens to the gods. He's the one who's attuned. He's out in the ocean. He's going to drown if he doesn't make it to an island. And then he hears a river god saying, hey, you can land here. It's like he's tuned in to the other world, and he swims to that spot, and he's able to get onto the island. It's like these myths are actually, they're not talking about Achilles or Odysseus or some ancient warrior or something thousands of years ago. They're talking about you.
Right.
And that's, it's practical, and yet it's also profound. So.
All right. And on that note, as I said, we'll have you back at some point, but Check out his blogs. Check out his books. David Matheson, thank you so much for spending some time with us, David.
Thanks a lot, Soraya.
And appropriately enough, I'm going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation talking about the mathematics of the universe. This is Worrying World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you?